beautiful night kind of starts out mellow and becomes something else much rowdier by the end of it. A collaboration between Mr. Ringo Starr and his pal Paul McCartney. Those two, I got to see them about 10 days ago. They were on a stage here in Las Vegas at the Mirage Hotel, joking and chatting with the audience. And afterward, Ringo gave an interview in which he said he wants to tour with McCartney, and he'd do it tomorrow if McCartney asks. That's kind of would be interesting to see. We shift gears now. If you're like me as a kid, you went to the Frankenstein movies and Dracula, Wolfman, a Creature from the Black Lagoon. You read sci-fi magazines about aliens, things of that sort, movie monster magazines. And if you did any of that stuff, then chances are pretty good you crossed paths with a character named Forrest J. Ackerman. And I emphasize character. He was a luminary in the early history of science fiction and an ardent, lifelong atheist who, in conversations with his friends, promised that if he were to die, and if he were able, after he died, to send them a message from the afterlife, that he would do it. And over the course of the last couple of years, people who were close to Ackerman have been receiving messages very much like that. As we learned earlier this year when Paul Davids joined me, this quest began because of a series of strange things that have turned in now to dozens of incidents, several of which have been investigated by reputable scientists. And after they joined the investigation, then weird stuff started happening to them. We're going to pick up this story of an atheist in heaven now that the book is out, and keeping a promise to Paul that I would have him back on the program once the book was released. So in a moment, Paul Davids and an atheist in heaven. I think we probably wouldn't get much of an argument in suggesting that the biggest unanswered question of all is what happens to us after we die. I think we'd like to believe that something lives on, that we are somehow eternal beings, whether it's heaven or hell or some parallel dimensions or something. And when you have asked that question, if you presume that there's something does go on, is it possible to communicate with the people who are still on this plane after you're somewhere else? We don't know. I mean, psychics, mediums, shaman would have one answer. Scientists, skeptics, atheists would have a very different answer. Some who, like Forrest J. Ackerman, would say, well, after you die, you remember what it was like before you were born? That's kind of what it was like. It would be like after you die. Forrest Ackerman, as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, was a lifelong atheist who jokingly said to friends that maybe after he dies, he would reach out to them. And it seems like that's exactly what Forrest is doing. Paul Davids rejoins us now to talk about his book that's now out, An Atheist in Heaven. Paul, great to have you back.
George, thanks for having me back. I'm glad we can continue our conversation that we began, I think, a few months ago.
Yeah. So let's start with sort of the big overview question. Where were you on this scale, atheism, believer, before you started down this path working on this project?
Well, I wasn't an atheist, but I wasn't raised religiously. I think that the main thing that had influenced me was back in 1983. I was working for F. Lee Bailey. You remember the attorney?
Sure.
He was in the O.J. Simpson case. And F. Lee Bailey had a television show called Lie Detector. Our polygrapher was Edward Gelb, who was head of the American Polygraph Society. In fact, he's the one that did the polygraphs in the Travis Walton case. So I was part of that production team, and I brought in for one of our episodes Dorothy Allison from New Jersey, a psychic detective. And she came to take a polygraph to see whether her story held up, that she had located one particular murder victim through psychic means, through communication with the victim. And she came with a dossier of letters from police departments in New Jersey and other states attesting that she had really helped them in many cases where there were missing persons and there had been a murder. She passed her polygraph, and I was extremely impressed with the evidence that she presented in that case. So at that point, I'm regarding it kind of intellectually. You know, I haven't had a personal experience. But I had to say to myself, look, she did give the clues that resulted in finding a number of bodies. She wasn't involved in the murders. So where did the information come from? It had to come from some other plane, and she claimed it came from the spirits of the murder victims. So if you buy that, then you've got to make the leap and say, okay, there is a realm that the spirit goes to after death, and that communication is possible. Like the spiritualists, you know, were telling us 100 years ago, people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who created Sherlock Holmes, he said, you know, I don't believe that this stuff is true. He said, I know it's true. You know, I've heard from my son who died in World War I. So you have all that body of things. Now, in my case, I knew Fari Akerman from the time I was a teenage boy. Loved him, loved his famous Monsters of Filmland magazine and his great sense of humor. Very wry, a little bit warped. You know, think of him as kind of a Mark Twain of the monster world. He had a tongue-in-cheek about everything. And I won a contest that was in his magazine when I was a kid for filmmaking, and it helped start me on my decision that I would go into film. And I've been working in television and film now for, you know, more than 30 years since the original Transformers show. So Fari and I were close, and I did know he was an atheist, and, you know, eventually he got up to his 90s. He reached 92. He had promised us he was going to live to 100, but he checked out at 92. That was December 4th, 2008. And what he had said to me was, sort of jokingly, look, you know, there's no afterlife. It's like a light bulb goes out. But he said, you know, if I'm wrong, maybe I'll drop you a line. Well, there was something about that phrase, you know, drop you a line. He was an editor, and he edited many, many manuscripts for the magazine. It was almost 200 issues of the magazine that he did. So the reason I began to think I had heard from him at first in 2009, it dawned on me slowly, but there was an incident that shocked me that happened about 1 week after a huge tribute for him in Hollywood, the Egyptian Theater. There were two Canadian filmmakers at that tribute who had made a biography of Fari, and they said they heard from him that weekend within an hour of rapping on his crypt. Now, the story of how they heard from him, instrumental transcommunication, computers involved, CAPTCHA code involved, his name on a CAPTCHA code. It's all recounted both in this new book, An Atheist in Heaven, which I wrote with Dr. Gary Schwartz.
Yeah, sorry for leaving him out.
Okay. Yeah. And also a contributor to it who's going to join us, I think, tonight is Dr. John Allison,
yep,
a chemist of the College of New Jersey. And the book is a follow-on to a film I made, a documentary. It was on Sci-Fi. It was released in 2013, called The Life After Death Project. Well, it was about a week after the tribute and what happened to the Canadians that had left a kind of an impression on me. And something happened to me, George, I swear to God, that it was like walking into the Twilight Zone, or like the Twilight Zone had walked into my world. Something impossible happened to me. And it involved ink on a document. Simply stated what it was, I had a document I'd printed out an hour and a half earlier. I'm alone in our vacation house in Santa Fe. Doors are locked. Pretty big house, two stories. I'm alone in the house. And I toss the document on my bed. I'm going to go over it for tax purposes. It's a diary of dates, phone calls, business lunches, things like that. And I knew the document was fine. I'd looked at it, and of course the ink was dry. It had been printed out an hour and a half earlier before I sat down to look at it. I was out of the room for about 5 minutes. And when I came back into the room, I could see right away that the document had been changed. There was a black, obliterated section of ink, very neatly and precisely done, where some words were completely blacked out, and the ink, or dye or paint, I didn't know what it was at that point in time, was still moist. Couldn't have happened. Now, just to tell you, first friend I talked to about it said, oh, come on, it was your printer. It must have been your printer. Well, no, wasn't the printer.
Because you had seen it.
Certain. The ink was dry, and it was when I left the room. And, other people said, okay, what about a leaky ceiling? You know, water drips from the ceiling on this thing. What about a leaky pen in the bed? And the skeptics say, oh, you know, that smudge you're talking about. Well, look, it was not a smudge. This is the reason for this case. This is the reason for years of research. It's the reason for my involving scientists at three universities to study this, because, look, you know, I've been involved in the UFO world, the movie Roswell. I know how much in paranormal cases hard evidence is valued. I treated it as evidence from the beginning. I didn't touch it. I kept the chain of custody. When Dr. Jay Siegel, the chairman of the chemistry department, Indiana University, suggested I FedEx it to him so he could begin studying it, I said, no, Dr. Siegel, I am getting on a plane. It's not going to leave my possession. What if it should be lost? We'd never have an answer. So thus began this research. Now, we're going to hear from one of the scientists, as I said, Dr. Allison, later on. One thing I want to make absolutely clear, it's all true. Everything in the book, An Atheist in Heaven, the 100 times Fari has dropped me a line now in the years since 2009, not always the same way. It's involved all kinds of things, from apports to instrumental transcommunication to extraordinary synchronicities to communication with mediums. All of it, every word of it is true. I put a sworn affidavit at the beginning saying, take this book as if I was testifying in court. And my ire is raised when people such as one reviewer, anybody can write a review at Amazon, says, you know, I think it's all a trick. I think this guy is fooling us. We have nothing really to go by here except one man's word, and why should we believe his affidavit? Well, I took offense at it. I just want to say that's wrong. I undertook this project for the benefit of science and to put it all on the record, and now it's all on the record.
I could say that, you know, it would have been very easily for you to just, oh, that's interesting. There's a smudge or there's an ink stain on this paper. I wonder how that got there, and this went on with your life. But
yeah. I did.
There were so many other things that,
at that moment, yeah. It stopped. You know, it was so impossible because it was so precise. That, as the scientist said who saw this, clearly that document was targeted. Clearly those words were targeted. Therefore, it was some kind of a message done by someone who could not be seen. And there was no one else in the house. So that began the research, and here was the puzzle as I presented it to the scientist I talked to who cooperated in this for years of study. I said, look, please explain this away if you can. If you can find some normal explanation, quiet my mind, get me off of this idea that the ghost did this, you know, please, you know, help me out. But if you can't, you know, I want to know. Use your best tools. So we get into mass spectrometry. We get into laser desorption, taking microscopic little samples of the ink and testing it against control groups. And as you will hear from Dr. John Allison, who was one of the several scientists who worked on this, really weird stuff started happening to him as soon as he took the assignment.
We'll get into that in a moment. Back to Forrest Ackerman, it's important to set the stage a little bit more on what a character he was. Not only a colorful character and a smart guy and funny, he emphasized puns, wordplay, things of that sort. I mention that because I can see somebody saying, Well, if this guy has done dozens and dozens of things to you and other people involved in the case, why wouldn't he just write something in his own handwriting on the mirror of the wall saying, hey, it's me, Forey, I'm speaking to you from beyond the grave, and make it just really, really obvious, as opposed to doing things in this manner that are not so obvious, like a trail of breadcrumbs. I think it seems to be that if your version is accurate, that he wants you to work at it as an investigation as opposed to just getting all at once.
Well, there's also the question as to what it's possible to do in terms of the communication between these realms. I mean, Jomo, who was Forey's caretaker for the last 10 years of his life, closest person to him, said he had an apparition of Forey. Now, he said, was he hallucinating? You know, was it some kind of surreal dream? He said it felt more real than life itself. And he said it felt like Forey came and spoke to me. And, you know, the words that were blacked out in my document were telling me that, you know, if you saw something that said spoke to Joe Mo, and you heard from Joe Mo that he, you know, right after the tribute, that he has this apparition, wouldn't you think these things are connected? Well, Joe Mo's name was contained in the name that was blacked out. So Forey loved names within names, puns, words within words. I found, you know, dozens of examples of that all over the place. It was his style, his sense of humor. Now, as to your question, why doesn't he just write me a letter or phone me? Can he communicate that directly? Or an EVP? What about electronic voice phenomena, where he's actually talking to me? Well, I want to set the stage with something like this, to say how self-referential these phenomena actually can be. So you do have, essentially, the signature of the person it's coming from. I have in my home office a mask of Forey Ackerman. It was in his mansion for decades. He called it the Acker Mansion. It was a science fiction museum. Writer Ray Bradbury called it the Fort Knox of science fiction. So I have this mask in my home office, and it had not moved. I kept it in one place for a couple of years at that point. And I was working on the documentary of the Life After Death Project, putting together the video of all the unusual things that had been happening, many that were caught actually on videotape. So the very day that I heard that the documentary was accepted for being broadcast nationally on the Sci-Fi Channel, that day, when I was out of the house for lunch, no one in the house, door to my office is closed, no open windows, I come back, and the mask of Forey has moved 8 to 10 feet across the room. So in that case, it's his face that's moving with no explanation. And immediately afterwards, the computer shuts down. I have two screens, video editing. And when I boot it back up, there are open folders, one on each screen, that were not open before. One of them is a folder all of photos of Forey Ackerman, which is in my hard drive. And the other is a folder of articles about famous monsters of Filmland magazine. So, George, bottom line, this stuff can be very, very specific to him, with one event following right on the heels of another. You know, like when he changes the music going on my iPod from Bob Dylan to suddenly playing the Phantom of the Opera, which was his favorite thing. On a day when he's been the topic of conversation. So that's the way it manifests.
So the first step you do is what a good investigator would do. You take the piece of physical evidence that you had, the document, and you want to get some scientific analysis. You go to Joe Siegel.
It was Dr. Jay Siegel.
Who's
one of the top forensic chemists in the world.
And he ends up, he has a weird event that you can tell us about in the next segment. And then he also sends you on to Dr. Allison, right? I'll tell you what, that music tells us we're coming up to a break. When we come back, Dr. John Allison will join us and tell us what role he played in the investigation and about some of the strange things that started happening to him. We're talking with Paul Davids about his new book, An Atheist in Heaven, The Ultimate Evidence for Life After Death, co-written with Gary Schwartz, back in a moment. John Fogerty took us into the break. A band called Cake brings us out of the break. The song, somewhat provocative title there, Short Skirt, Long Jacket. That's a fun tune. We're talking with Paul Davids about his new book, co-written with Gary Schwartz, An Atheist in Heaven, about a series of really strange events related to the late Forrest Ackerman that they began investigating. Among the scientists that they turned to help take a look at some physical evidence is Dr. John Allison, currently the director of the forensic chemistry program at the College of New Jersey, who got a PhD in physical chemistry from the University of Delaware. He's published more than 100 papers, made more than 250 public presentations of his research, did his postdoctoral fellowship from the National Science Foundation at Stanford, and perhaps asked himself at some point, what's a good scientist like me doing in a crazy story like this? In a moment, we'll ask him that himself. He'll join us right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Davids and Dr. Gary Schwartz co-wrote the new book, An Atheist in Heaven, but two of the chapters are written by John Allison, PhD, chemistry professor that I just gave you his credentials a couple of minutes ago. Dr. Allison, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George.
So is there any point where you're saying to yourself, what's a reputable guy like me doing mucking around in this kind of crazy stuff? I mean, there are consequences. Any trepidation at all for a guy with your credentials?
I'm not afraid of anything, George.
I read that you actually were familiar with Forrest Ackerman. As a youngster, you read the same kind of stuff that I read and that Paul read.
I certainly was. I had never met him, but he was really a great source of entertainment for lots of us.
And I imagine, I mean, sci-fi, there is a science in sci-fi that maybe that was some of what you read there helped help hook you on science topics in general.
It could be. I had a science teacher in high school who had Stranger Than Science by Frank Edwards.
Yeah.
The book was written in the 60s, but if we were good that week, he would save part of Friday and just read to us from that book. And I don't know how people couldn't get hooked after listening to the sorts of things that were in there. We just never heard stories like that before. And next thing you know, I was out buying Hans Holzer books and just reading as much as I could.
I think Frank Edwards wrote a pretty famous UFO book, if I'm not mistaken. So, Paul, did you have to make a sales pitch to Dr. Allison to get him on board?
Well, actually, it was Dr. Siegel who made the sales pitch. They had worked together at Michigan State on a big project involving inks, solvents, paints, dyes. And I think there were reasons that you were hesitant at first, John, right? But then you did agree, and you had me fly the document out to you. And then that's when... yeah, it really began.
Well, we'll get into the weird stuff in a minute. Let's start with the science part of it. What was your primary task, and how did you go about it, John?
Well, my primary task was to figure out whether this guy was legit or not. And you know, I had to approach this as a forensic scientist, and you know, he tells me a story that something happens in his house and there's no one in the house but him, so he has to be the, you know, a possible suspect. But this was back before he was thinking about writing a book or making a documentary, or he just had a simple question of, you know, how did this happen? A line on a piece of paper had been crossed out. It's called an obliteration, and by document examiners, where you can't read the line anymore. And he just wanted to know, you know, did somebody have a magic marker or a certain kind of pen or something that could cross this line out so that you couldn't read it anymore? So he had just, you know, very basic questions, and I often would call him. I would sort of come up with some ideas and then see if maybe I could get him to tell me something that might help me understand whether he was really involved or not. And it didn't take long to really be convinced that he just had a simple question, and it was a scientific question, and he wanted to see if he could find an answer.
Dr. Siegel, the guy who called you up and asked you about getting involved in this, had said to Paul, this line on this document was targeted.
Right.
Did you reach that conclusion, or was that not even something that you tried to answer or address?
The way it's crossed out just exactly over the letters. So it's not certainly not something accidental. It's not like something splashed on the page. It was one line that was picked out.
So tell me what analyses you did to try to figure out, the nature of the ink, what the chemical composition was. What tests did you run?
Well, as Paul said, we have a kind of mass spectrometer, an analytical tool that uses a laser, and with the laser you focus it right on a piece of paper, and if there's any ink on there, anything on the paper, molecules just pop right off, and now they're free and you can analyze them. It's the technique I've been using for about 20 years now. So, and I started analyzing ink, so I was pretty confident that this wasn't going to be a problem. Actually, it should be a pretty simple thing to do. I had a few complications. It was a very unusual ink, and even more unusual because Paul had the same laser printer as I did. So it was interesting because I could make hundreds of copies of print from this printer, and then I could give it to different students that I had to investigate what the connection was. And it turns out, usually when a printer prints black, it's carbon-based. So it's just very finely ground up carbon. And you can't wash that off a page or anything. But Hewlett-Packard, when they made this color printer, for some reason the ink they made, the black ink they made, had a blue dye in it. And so you could lick your finger and just run your finger over a line, and blue would come out of the black printing. And that's what this was. It was actually a dye that was in the black printing all along. And somehow, someone with a solvent and using some kind of tool just went across the line and extracted the blue out of the black to the point where you couldn't read the original printing anymore.
So it had to have been done on purpose, using solvent and a tool to remove that part of the ink.
Right. And I spent a lot of time just looking at this under a microscope first and thinking about what the possibilities are. And it seemed to me like the tool, the weapon that was used in this crime, could have been a paintbrush. And so that was one more call from me to Paul. I'm just trying to very subtly get into the conversation of, do you have any hobbies? Does your wife have any hobbies? And it's when he told me that he was a painter. Another interesting situation. And when he came to visit me, he actually brought a lot of his brushes and things. So, never.
So you tested them?
Oh, yeah. And we didn't find any connection, but you could use something as simple as water and almost get this to work, but not quite. And I've had students work on this full time. I've worked on it full time. I've had a couple different classes where I have 20 students, and part of their lab time was spent on this project. So there's many hundreds of research hours put into this. And that really convinced me that this was legitimate, because Paul couldn't have done it, because he wouldn't have known how, because I don't know how.
So you tried to reproduce it, right? You and your students tried to reproduce it in some way, and I'm
hundreds of times, yep.
And you couldn't.
Nope. It's a really simple reason. If you use a brush and you pick up some kind of solvent on the brush, you can go across one of these printed lines, and the blue ink will come out. But I'd never thought about this much before, but if you start with water and you're picking up color, half the color gets smeared across the page, but the other half is picked up by the brush. So the brush almost, prohibits you. Using any kind of tool at all to do this prohibits you from getting it to look like Paul's sample did, because even if you lick your finger and go across the line, you'll see the blue come out, but also your finger will be blue. So you can just never get all of that ink to stay on the page.
So this was done kind of carefully, methodically, accurately. Paul, let me ask you this. Did you set up Dr. Allison sort of in this way, saying, we've been having a lot of weird things happen to us, let him know that to be on the lookout for anything strange? I mean, were his antenna up?
And, yeah, I was honest about what my tentative conclusion was. John, I just want to say, I think one thing that might have gotten left out of your explanation was the fact that when you draw blue out like that, that you can never make it opaque to absolutely black out words. Isn't that the point, the opaqueness, that no solvent, nothing you tried could ever get it dark enough so you couldn't read the words? Wasn't that the issue?
Right. If you could lick your finger and go across the line, but you didn't actually have a finger,
yeah.
Just the water, you could probably do it. But to actually have to use some kind of tool, you can never get it dark enough.
Never dark enough. It, when I went to John, as I had with Dr. Siegel, I said what my hypothesis was, that we'd had this big tribute for Fari, that these Canadians had said they heard from him within an hour of knocking on his crypt, that he'd said he would drop me a line. If he died and it was possible to communicate, this is a line. He was an editor. I searched for examples of his editing style. I found many examples. I found examples exactly like this where he methodically blacked things out rather than just drawing a line through it, even in two different levels of darkness. And this, what happened to me, was in two different levels of darkness. You could still kind of read the first two words, spoke to. But the name that followed was what was completely blacked out. So I said to John, all of this, that I was entertaining the idea that ghosts were real and I had been visited by a ghost. And it's kind of funny. If you see the movie I made first, The Life After Death Project, you can find all this at Amazon, by the way. So the movie came first. It's a DVD now. And I said to John, because he said, we've got to look for some reasonable explanation that caused this. And I said, well, is it not reasonable that this could have been done by someone from a realm beyond our physical realm that we cannot see? And with kind of a smirk on his face, John said, well, I don't have any data on that. He said, I don't usually look for explanations that involve somebody returning from the dead. And that was his attitude at first. But what unfolded was an extraordinary adventure, because really weird stuff started happening to John then. And John has written two chapters in the book, one about our return to the Acker Mansion for further studies, and we're going to get into that further when I think you're going to talk to the owner of the Acker Mansion, Mark Rawlings. But in other words, stuff that shouldn't have happened started happening and plaguing John in his life, and it involved clocks chiming that shouldn't have chimed, papers scattering off a chair when there was nothing to scatter them, cell phone moving off a mantle repeatedly on its own and falling to the ground, a Furby toy starting to talk to him, and at one point it sounded like saying Forey's name. Forey would often write his name, the number four, and then an E, 4E. And then there was the Furby toy that said 4E a couple of times, right, John? And the battery should have been dead because they were five-year-old batteries, right?
Yep.
So
yeah, most of the time I just was rolling my eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in the chemistry, but of course Paul's there saying, isn't there any possibility that if you can't explain it, it could be someone from the afterlife? And I've never had to go there for an explanation for chemistry before. So that's
so then odd things start happening to you personally as you're working on this. And I don't know, maybe you can slough off the first one, but at what point do you start thinking, wow, this is a little bit too strange?
John, tell us about what happened when you owed me the chapter. I'd asked you to finish the chapter for the book, and you had kept putting off doing it, and you were in the lab doing something else, and it was on your conscience, gee, I should finish that chapter for Paul and get it off to him. He needs it. And then tell about what happened in the lab, the way your equipment behaved strangely and the drawer kept pushing out into your arm.
I was sitting in front of the same instrument that I used to analyze Paul's sample. I think Paul's sample was still in the instrument. A couple things started to happen. The instrument started to shut itself down. And I wasn't ready to shut down, but there's a button you push that says, you know, shut down for the day, and I hadn't touched that. But suddenly things are whirring and buzzing, telling me that the instrument's starting to shut down. So I had to stop it from doing that a couple times. And there's a shelf that a keyboard's on, and it started pushing me back. And I would push against it, it would push back. And it was just something I sat in front of probably for 10 years and never had any this sensation before of the instrument sort of pushing me away. It's like it didn't want me to be there. It wanted me to, I don't know, do something else. But
that was an incident with a pile of papers at your home, right?
Right. And you know, a lot of these things I don't think about at all. I mean, Paul has his antennas up, plus he knows about, you know, things that parallel just random things that happened to me. So I didn't think anything of it. I think it was the morning that Paul was coming here because he wanted to film the analysis and he didn't want to leave his documents unattended. So I had printed some pictures because Paul was smart enough to take pictures of this, the pages right after it happened. So he had the front side and the back side and the front side of the next page, and he really did a good job of documenting what was really there initially. And I had made a bunch of copies for my students. I just set them on a chair. I got a shower and came back, and they were all on the ground. They were spread out on the floor. It was sort of an unusual thing. I just thought, oh, okay, the paper fell off the chair. I don't know how, but paper fell off the chair. I don't think twice about that. I know gravity works. But when I told him, he was really interested in it. I didn't have any reason to tell him, but he seemed to be interested in things like this, so I told him that paper fell off a chair. And he wanted to see it. So he said, oh, can we go back to your house at the end of the day, and can we just sort of reproduce this so you can show me? So we went back to my house, and I spent about 20 times putting a pile of paper on a chair and knocking it off, and they just fall to the ground. They don't fan out.
So they never, when you tried to do it deliberately, they never scattered the way they did the morning,
right,
when I brought you the document for research.
Well, is it possible a breeze came through a window or a door? Do you have a cat, anything like that?
No, it was in the summer. I don't have even an air conditioner in the dining room. All the windows were closed, no pets.
George, it caught my attention so severely because I had interviewed the current, what were then the current tenants at the former Acker Mansion,
right.
The 18-room mansion, and one of them was a musician who had practiced at the foot of the stairs going downstairs right next to what had been Fari's office.
I'll tell you what, hold that story. When we come back, we'll talk about the Acker Mansion and then bring in the current owner of the Acker Mansion to speak about some strange stuff going on there. We're talking about An Atheist in Heaven, the new book by Paul Davis and Gary Schwartz with contributions from Dr. John Allison. Back in a moment.